oftentimes it's better to start with creativity to help you learn the facts.
Life is too short to learn a list of 1,000 rando words.
From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In with your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, Dean of the Graduate School of Education. And I should point out that this is a time during COVID-19, so we're not physically in the studio together. We, Dan and I, are each recording from our homes via Zoom, and our guest will be recording from his home via Zoom as well.
Well, Dr. Polyglot Pope.
Speaking lots of languages?
Yes.
Is that what polyglot?
Yes.
I don't speak a lot of languages, Dan.
You don't? You didn't take like high school French?
I took high school Spanish, and I went to Hebrew school for years. So I would say I have working knowledge of Hebrew and Spanish, and that's about it.
So that when you get a PhD, back in the day, you had to show proficiency in a second language, right?
So
you could read the literature in another language. So I don't actually speak a second language, but I knew how to program. So I was able to convince them that knowing how to program Fortran counted as a second language.
Oh, what a racket. Unbelievable, Dan. Only you would figure out a way to go around that language requirement.
Yeah, I thought I was very clever.
That's pretty funny.
I wish I spoke several languages, but I don't.
Well, now, of course, I do too. A lot of people do. And it's actually what we're going to talk about on this show is people who are English language learners. So by nature, they have, when they finally do learn English, they are at least at a number two for polyglot. So I have a little quiz for you because I found out some very interesting information about English language learners. Are you up for a quiz?
This one's going to hurt, but yes.
Yeah, this is tough. There are some very surprising things here. So first of all, let's talk about what percentage of students nationally are English language learners.
8%.
Ooh, Dan, not bad. It's around 10%. Yeah.
That's not bad.
Yeah, it's around 10%. Now, in California, it's a little bit different. What would you imagine it is in California, in public schools?
22.3%. Okay. My confidence is up.
Your confidence is way up. Well, it's actually 18%. Definitely higher than nationwide. Nationwide, 3.8 million students in the U.S. schools are native Spanish speakers who are not proficient in English. So I thought that was interesting. Okay. Yeah, it's a lot. Let me give you another one. How many languages are spoken in California schools/homes?
Right? Oh my God. How many languages are there in the world?
Well,
Is there like, let's see, French, English, Spanish, Latin, dead Greek? Okay.
It's going to take us way too long to name.
Okay. Okay. I'm going to go. sorry. It was in LA, Los Angeles,
California.
California.
All of California. Yeah. Not just LA.
Okay. I'm going to go 56.
So interesting. The state collects data on 75 languages.
75. That was my second guess.
However,
but it wasn't my second guess.
Okay, wait. But more than 90% of students speak one of the top 10 languages. You want to know what the top 10 languages, right? Spanish, Vietnamese, Mandarin, Arabic, and others. So just so you know.
Wow.
As an aside, we translated some back-to-school tips for parents at the School of Ed into 8 different languages for San Francisco Unified. So, this is not just like, oh, it's Spanish or Mandarin or English. There's a lot of kids out there speaking lots of different languages. Okay, two more questions. One, this was surprising to me. What percentage of English language students graduate from high school in 4 years?
Sorry, what percentage of students who come in with
who are rated as English learners? So they're not proficient yet. They're rated as English learners.
And what percent graduate? of long-term English learners?
Yeah, from high school in 4 years, what percent?
25.
So 59. But I was surprised. 59 to me, this particular person who I read this in was saying, you know, that's not good. I agree it's not good, but it's more than I thought. Like I would have guessed lower too.
Yeah, it depends how they categorize. There's different categorizations of long-term English learners. You know, some haven't really shown much gain in English proficiency.
And over so that, the time.
It's going to be quite different.
Some might be coming in just at the high school level. Yeah. So, and then, okay. So last question, how many states explicitly require English language teachers to have an English learners certification, a special certification for teaching English learners? How many states explicitly require that?
To get any job or to be in a room where you're also teaching kids?
To teach English learners.
Let's say 6.
It's 20. Still way lower than it should be, right? Only 20 explicitly require English language teachers to have English language learners certification. So that's the end of my quiz. Dan, you did okay. You did okay.
Yeah.
I'm glad we have an expert here to help us out, particularly about the sort of how you teach English language learners, right? So I'm here. I'm going to welcome Ramon Martinez. He's an education professor at Stanford who studies language and literacy, specifically the practices of bilingual Chicano and Latinx children and youth. He's going to talk with us about the particular challenges and opportunities for online and distance learning when you're an English language learner, which is a whole other set of challenges. So welcome. Welcome, Ramon.
Hi, Dan, Denise. Thanks so much for having me.
It's good to have you back. We have a teacher education program called STEP, Stanford Teacher Education Program, and we made the decision to put it online. So there are a lot of schools that are putting their teacher education program on pause. We decided we couldn't do that. We shouldn't do that. So now lots of our teacher candidates are going to be working with classes with ESL students online. And when they graduate, right, they're going to be working with lots of English second language learners. It's California. You heard the percentages. So how do we prepare teachers to teach ESL online? Do we do anything special?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it's a tricky question. You know, as with any kind of online learning, there's some affordances and some challenges. I think, I won't presume to tell you all about the affordances of online learning in general. I think for students who are classified as English learners, I think there are a couple opportunities that emerge when you think about online learning. So obviously the challenge associated with being apart from teachers, away from teachers and friends, classmates, I think sort of the flip side of that is that distance creates an opportunity for communication, for correspondence, right? So oftentimes in schools, language and literacy instruction, we try to get kids to imagine and invoke particular audiences, right? Real, authentic audiences. I think now kids have some real authentic audiences that they miss, right? People that they really don't get to see in person anymore. And so I think using that as sort of a centerpiece, right? Who are the people that you care about that you don't get to see in person anymore? And what kinds of genres might you write across with these particular audiences in mind? So audience as sort of like a frame, I think, has been something that we've used in our conversations with teachers and other educators about how to talk to kids about authentic opportunities for communication and engagement virtually.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We're talking with Ramon Martinez about how to teach English language learners and the particular challenge, some affordances and some challenges of really learning online, which is what many kids I know, at least in California right now, I think Governor Newsom said 90% of the state will be learning remotely in the fall.
So that's interesting. You know, that if you're teaching online, everything's incredibly intentional. You sort of have to plan everything. You have to plan all social interactions for kids. And you're flipping that. So now that you're dominoing that. So now that the kids in this world have to be very intentional about their communication as well. I hadn't thought of that. It's interesting.
Absolutely. And I think you can think across modalities, right? Across genres. So not just the traditional letter writing that we might engage in with pen pals. I mean, kids now have an opportunity to have some pen pals that they actually know from before the pandemic, right? But texting, right? online communication, communicating through video gaming, all the kinds of things that kids are interested in. I think there are lots of opportunities for kids to communicate with other kids and with teachers.
So does this have a special interaction with English as a second language?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, it's sort of related to some of the concerns that teachers have, right? We've been talking to lots of teachers. We've been working with Tulare County Office of Education, which oversees 43 districts in California's Central Valley. A couple of weeks ago, I spoke with an audience of about 600 teachers in Los Angeles Unified. They were dual language and world language teachers who work with kids classified as English learners. And you know, I think these teachers are understandably concerned about some of the challenges, right?
What'd you tell them? 600's a lot of people.
Yeah, if you have 600 people in a room, what are you going to tell them, right?
I mean,
pet issues that I like to tell. I mean, of course, I want them to write for real audiences. And I imagine some of those audiences will be bilingual, multilingual kids just like themselves. So what might it mean to think across beyond linguistic borders and boundaries, right? Right. What does it mean to write with another bilingual audience in mind? So I talked to them about stuff like that. But I think across those two groups, the educators in Tulare County and LA County and some of the other districts around the country that I've been working with, you know, these people are concerned about English learners, about issues of access, right? Just basic internet, online access to related technologies, to instructional materials, you know, access to other English speakers. For kids who are acquiring English as an additional language, you know, one of the key ingredients, right, for second language acquisition, we know, is time for meaningful, authentic engagement, interaction. So there's a real concern about whether or not kids are getting this at home, how to kind of provide those kinds of opportunities for kids virtually, I think is a big concern. The flip side of this for us is that this category of English learner is like all labels. It's a label that conceals more than it reveals, right? It masks tremendous diversity, variation, heterogeneity. And so you've got kids who are really, truly acquiring English as an additional language for the first time. And then you have on the other end of the continuum, kids who are long-term English learners, some of whom were maybe misclassified initially, who actually are English dominant, speak more English than they do their native or heritage language, right? And you've got everybody in between. And so we have concerns about these kids not speaking English. But one thing that I've found just in my conversations with families and teachers, that a lot of these kids, you know what they're doing at home while on quarantine and now learning remotely? That they're speaking English. They're speaking a lot of English with their siblings, right? A lot of these kids have older siblings. A lot of these kids have younger siblings who speak English, even if their parents don't. So there's a lot of English speaking going on, a lot more English speaking than we realize. And so part of what we want to do is tap into what's happening at home, try to understand better what kids are actually doing, because we think that can inform the instructional opportunities we design for them remotely.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We're talking with Ramon Martinez about English language learners, and particularly during COVID-19. That's a surprising fact that you said, Ramon. I thought you were going to say they're not speaking English because really at home only, let's say, Spanish is being spoken. But you're saying, no, you're finding that they actually are speaking English to siblings, et cetera. What, you know, why do you think that is?
Yeah, I mean, anecdotally, again, we're definitely finding that. And of course, there are lots of cases of kids who aren't speaking as much English at home and maybe who don't have any family members at all who speak English. But even the kids without parents who speak English, what we're learning is that a lot of these kids are engaging with siblings, cousins, with their classmates online, like they're video gaming, right? They're watching Netflix. So some of the concerns that we've heard teachers articulate are things that we've tried to flip and sort of pivot and say, okay, this is a concern. We understandably, and especially given histories of marginalization and inequality, we have good reason to be concerned about how kids who are classified as English learners are going to fare in the current moment. But what we're trying to do is sort of pivot and reframe these challenges as opportunities. So a perfect example is like when we hear teachers express concerns about, well, the only thing my kids are doing at home is they're watching Netflix and playing video games, right? So we're like, perfect. So we've talked about things like that as opportunities for them to learn English, right? We had a whole conversation with teachers about subtitles and on Netflix, right? And how to use subtitles, like subtitles in English for Spanish movies, for example, subtitles in Spanish for English, right? How to translate things for parents and for other family members who maybe don't speak any English. So lots of opportunities for that, for video gaming and communicating via video games with other classmates and friends and peers. So there's all kinds of opportunities there. We've also heard, you know, a lot of teachers say, well, my kids aren't really learning anything. They're just doing, they're cooking at home with their parents. And so we did a whole lesson for the Tulare County folks on, well, how could you create a lesson around cooking, right? Cooking demos, recipes as like a genre, a text, right? Imagine all the opportunities there are to translate, to search for recipes online, to translate and interpret recipes for parents in real time as you're cooking, ahead of time while you're planning, after the fact. Imagine cooking demos that you could do. And so we sort of unpacked and kind of zoomed in and did a deep dive into what all the opportunities for learning that emerge within just a single recipe, right? Connections to family heritage, right? And the fact that kids are learning to cook at home is not lost on us, right? Like the kids are learning about family culinary history and heritage with their loved ones, I think is great. But what we're trying to say is like, not only is that a great thing that they're doing with their family members, that's an opportunity for language learning, both in the moment, ahead of time, in the moment, and after the fact. And so we're trying to seize upon these everyday moments of interaction and encounters, experiences that kids are having with their family members, and see where's the point of pedagogical leverage there. And just to sort of you know, pull back the curtain and say, look at what you could do with this. And the teachers, once you sort of give them permission to do that, I think teachers have much better ideas than I do about opportunities for learning and how to leverage, kind of seize these moments as opportunities for teaching and learning.
I'm thrilled just from a life skills notion that we're seeing more kids actually be more independent and take on some traditionally adult roles and learn some of these skills because they need them when they launch. But I do think that there are parents thinking, why are they not doing schoolwork that traditionally looks like schoolwork? This doesn't look like the kind of schoolwork I had when I was growing up. How do you deal with that, Ramon?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. I think parents oftentimes will not see the value in what they're doing sometimes, or the sort of pedagogical potential in what they're doing, certainly, right? Like this is totally disconnected from what you do in schools. Like you all are in charge of that, and that's real learning. And what we're doing at home, you know, is over here and never the twain shall meet, right? And so I think, you know, we've had interesting conversations with parents, and we've talked to teachers who have had interesting conversations with parents. We put together this interview protocol for the Tulare County. Again, it's a county office of ed, which oversees 43 school districts. And so we had educators from all of these districts come together, these teams of, you know, school-based teams. And we gave them sort of like an interview protocol, kind of we called it a conversation guide, questions that they can ask. You know, because it's sort of like when you're connecting with families for the first time during a pandemic, it's tricky. And so we didn't want them to feel like they were, you know, it's a little bit invasive, and we didn't want the parents to feel like they were being judged. But we did want to learn about, first check in and see how they're doing, you know, first and foremost, but then to kind of learn more about what they're doing, right? And without passing judgment. So I think we steered away from, you know, asking about, well, what are your kids learning or how are they studying? And sometimes even when the teachers didn't ask parents these questions, the parents would go there. Well, they're doing their math and they're doing, you know. And what we really wanted to know is like, what else are they doing? What else are they doing and experiencing? You know, what are they learning formally and informally, but what else are they doing and experiencing that could serve as a resource for teaching and learning? So I think it's a tricky thing to try to convince parents that there's potential point of pedagogical leverage there, but I think it's something we're working on.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We're talking with Ramon Martinez about convincing parents and teachers, quite frankly, of all the real pedagogical opportunities and language learning opportunities going on during online learning, and particularly with activities they're doing at home. We'll have more with Ramon next on SiriusXM.
This is Schools In.
I'm not an expert at this. Okay. I'm more expert than you.
When you can't read in American society, you are really left out.
With Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope
from the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Ramon Martinez, an education professor here at Stanford, coming at us from Zoom today. And we're talking about how English language learners are learning things at home that a lot of their parents don't realize are really useful.
The role of the family now as part of school, a part of education, has really changed with COVID. It's particularly for elementary school, right? So if I understand correctly, what you did is you gave teachers protocols for talking to parents to find out sort of what's going on at home, and the teachers would give tips, or like, what are some of the questions that you would have the teachers ask?
Yeah, so this was, it was a conversation guide, kind of like an interview protocol, right? But very loosely structured. And the idea was, you know, we were working with groups of educators, teams of educators, school-based teams, and we gave them, they were part of a two-part, professional development or professional learning sequence. And so in that first session, we kind of introduced the key ideas and about tapping into learning at home, and what does it mean to tap into learning at home, to learn about what kids are doing and learning at home. And in between the first and the second session, we gave them homework. And the homework was to connect with a single family, to connect with one kid and that kid's family. And so, you know, we anticipated they'd want some support, that the educator teams, the teachers and other school-based folks would want some support. So we gave them this conversation guide with questions like, first of all, they had checking in, how are you doing, you know, first and foremost during this pandemic. But after sort of, you know, connecting with them, we wanted them to find out about what the kids were doing at home. And we steered them away from asking questions that were specifically or explicitly about learning and more focused on, well, what are these kids doing? And even with that being the case, some of the parents focused on learning because I think that's what they suspected that the teachers wanted to learn. Like, what are you kids learning at home? What are you teaching your kids? But we had probing and follow-up questions around, well, what are you kids doing with their siblings? What are they doing in their free time? What are they doing with you? And so we had these kind of probes and follow-up questions about what's been particularly easy? What's been challenging? What's been the hardest thing about being together at home during the pandemic? Again, the goal was, how can we learn about these kids' everyday lives during quarantine and now during remote learning? How do we ask in ways that are thoughtful and nuanced to understand what kids are doing?
Well, no, I was wondering, so I've done this. I now suddenly get a view into the family life of the child. As a teacher, did you see that they suddenly started changing how they were thinking of designing curriculum or reaching out to the kids?
I think it's a little early to tell. I think we're getting there in the sense that we've had some good conversations with these school-based teams where they're brainstorming pedagogical possibilities, right? Points of pedagogical leverage. So if a kid is just watching Netflix at home or just playing video games with friends or just cooking with their parent, our goal is to sort of unpack that, again, do a deep dive and say, what are all the different what are the learning activities and experiences and opportunities that we could design around what we know kids are already doing? Right. And so it's been a little work to convince parents and teachers that there's some pedagogical leverage there. There's some value and potential. But I think, you know, once you get the ball rolling, you know, the teacher we've been working with have been really excited about designing recipe lessons, right? Lessons based on recipes, teaching them cooking demos, if you will, things like that. So I think the idea is to learn more and not to necessarily teach in the moment of the interview and not to necessarily teach the next day, but to glean some insights that can inform your design of curriculum and instruction moving forward. Imagining a day beyond the pandemic when we're all learning together in person, right? So I think these are insights that can inform what we're doing now remotely, but that can also, you know, we can imagine related pedagogical possibilities beyond this pandemic when things are hopefully back to normal in terms of being together in person.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're talking with Ramon Martinez about some innovative ways to design curriculum around what's going on at home, particularly for English language learners, and turning some basic things like cooking or playing video games into some real learning moments.
So, Ramon, did in any of the information that's flowed back, have you noticed strong differences between high school and, say, elementary school interactions with families? Because what I've heard is, for elementary, you've got to have the parents involved. For high school, you have to convince the kids it's not homework. It's actually, this is school. And the families aren't quite as involved, except to sort of motivate and threaten if you don't do your work, you know. So has anything flowed back in these interviews with the parents or?
A little bit. I think the conversations I've had with teachers and with some parents myself, you know, I've learned that, yeah, there's a concern, first of all, among older students that there seems to be a greater concern that these students are less engaged, right? That they're not as present. We have multiple classes, multiple people to check in with, and that can create all kinds of challenges. In terms of parental involvement and parents being connected, I think, you know, I've seen some greater concern among parents of adolescents, of high school age students, right, around how to be involved and how to be supportive across their different classes. I think just the idea of a self-contained classroom, a single teacher versus multiple teachers, I think that can be a huge challenge from a parent's perspective, right? How many teachers do you need to connect with, and what app am I using to connect with this teacher versus that teacher? So I think there's some, you know, obvious challenges there. But I think the teachers that I've seen who have really kind of, rolled up their sleeves and taken advantage of these opportunities, they see that this is, you know, if ever there were a time for us to see parents as partners in education, now is that time. And so I think I'm really encouraged by the teachers that I see, again, rolling up their sleeves, connecting with parents, right, communicating, you know, teachers who recognize that a single app isn't going to do the trick, Right? A single online platform isn't always going to work for all parents, that they're going to have to go out of their way sometimes to make sure they're connecting with all parents. But I think, you know, that's, again, these are challenges and related opportunities. But it certainly is, I think, difficult for older kids just by virtue of the fact that they've got multiple teachers to keep track of.
I was just going to say, some of these populations, a lot of the older kids are having to go out and get a job to help with finances, take on, you know, so school becomes secondary. They are the primary caregiver now because both parents are essential workers. So they don't have a choice. They have to stay home with their siblings or they have to go get a job. So I'm hearing for that particular population, on top of we might not have internet, we might not have devices, there's just other priorities above and beyond school for them.
Yeah, I mean, this is what I think drives a lot of the concerns that I've heard among teachers, right? I mean, this is a population that is, I mean, obviously this is a moment of unprecedented educational crisis in addition to being a public health crisis. But what compounds this for many families of English learners is that these are also disproportionately, as you mentioned, families that are bearing the brunt of the public health crisis, that these are disproportionately Latinx families, immigrant families, poor and working class families. They're disproportionately, as you mentioned, frontline essential workers who are exposed to greater risk. So, you know, some of these families are facing unemployment and eviction, experiencing homelessness. So you've got some real, some very real, undeniable challenges for many of these families. And so learning English can take a backseat, right? It's not necessarily on the front of every family's sort of list of, the top of every family's list of priorities. And so understandably, right? So there's a lot going on. I think teachers realize this. And I think that this drives a lot of the concerns about what kids and families are going through, right? How do you prioritize learning English when there's so much else going on right now?
The video games are very interesting. Do you want to sneak into one of those video games and play with the kids and intersperse some English language lessons while you're, you know, no, there's six words for kill, you know?
Exactly.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I'm secretly very curious about this. Yes. And I've tried my son, I have a 10-year-old son who's very into video games. And that's actually, you know, something that I've personal firsthand experience. I see him interacting with his classmates. And so there's text, right? There's print-based literacy. For sure going on. There's interaction, right? Kids are talking to each other while they're, you know, correcting each other, you know, sort of critiquing each other's moves and decisions in sort of game world. So I think there's a lot of opportunities for authentic interaction there, for sure.
I think you just made a lot of kids happy, and I think you just made Dan happy. Thank you so much for being here, Ramon. Really informative. And thank all of you for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app and anywhere you listen to podcasts.
From the campus of Stanford University, this has been Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope on SiriusXM Business Radio. If you missed any of it, listen on demand, online, or with the SiriusXM app.